Let's start with a rather, well, a frankly jarring paradox that is currently defining the Australian economy.
Yeah, it really is a paradox.
Right, because if you look at the figures from 2023 and 2024, the manufacturing sector saw its real output grow by 4.1%, and its gross operating profits jumped by an astonishing 9.3%.
Which is massive.
It's massive.
Yeah.
By any conventional metric, you know, that is the profile of an industry right in the middle of an aggressive boom.
Absolutely.
Yet over the year leading up to February 2026, the sector actually shed 8,700 workers. It contracted.
It did.
And despite shedding those workers, manufacturing leaders are currently warning of this this existential crisis because they simply cannot find enough people to hire. There are tens of thousands of roles just sitting vacant right now.
It's a profound structural contradiction, isn't it?
Completely.
I mean, you have soaring profits and monumental capital investment operating right alongside a shrinking overall headcount. And that's then capped off by this acute structural talent shortage.
Right.
It completely defies the traditional economic logic that suggests, well, that booming profits naturally lead to mass job creation across the board.
Exactly. So for you listening, whether you are leading an operations team, maybe drafting a workforce strategy, evaluating your own career trajectory, or, you know, simply trying to understand the mechanics of the modern workforce, we are going to take this paradox apart today.
We really need to dig into the weeds on this one.
You do. And to do that, we have compiled a very comprehensive stack of sources to get to the bottom of it all. We're drawing heavily on a highly detailed May 2026 market briefing by Byron Thomas Recruitment.
That's a brilliant report, by the way.
It really is. And we are cross-referencing their sort of on-the-ground observations with hard empirical data from Jobs and Skills Australia, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and the CSIRO.
Plus the strategic side of things.
Exactly. To understand the strategic response, we're analyzing major recent reports from the big four consulting firms. So that's McKinsey, PwC, KPMG, Deloitte, and EY.
And synthesizing these specific sources is crucial here.
Why is that?
Because they offer completely different vantage points on the exact same crisis. I mean, the government data gives us the macro reality of the contraction.
Right, the big picture.
Yeah. But then the recruiters show us the immediate day-to-day friction of trying to fill a role on a Tuesday morning. And the strategic consultants reveal the sheer panic inside the boardroom regarding how to adapt to this new environment over the next 5 years.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's begin with the data from Jobs and Skills Australia and the Manufacturing Industry Skills Alliance.
Right.
We are looking at a sector that is projected to contribute over $100 billion to the Australian economy by 2025. It employs roughly 868,000 people.
A massive chunk of the workforce.
Huge. And as we mentioned, profits jumped to nearly 10%. But then you have that contraction, a loss of around 1% of the workforce.
Yeah, that 18,700 figure.
Yeah. And I try to conceptualize this, and it strikes me as being somewhat akin to a corporate fitness program.
How do you mean?
Well, it's like dropping overall body weight, but massively increasing your muscle mass. You know, you're physically smaller, but you're lifting much heavier weights. The overall mass of the sector is decreasing, but the density and power, so the profit and output, are increasing dramatically.
That's a really good way of looking at it.
But I want to push back on the aggregate numbers here.
Mm-hmm.
Because how is a sector actually achieving near double-digit profit growth while actively losing staff? It cannot just be, you know, standard automation replacing manual labor.
No. It is far more complex than simple automation. To really understand the mechanism driving this, we have to stop treating manufacturing as a single monolithic entity.
Right, it's not just one thing.
Exactly. The Byron Thomas briefing highlights that the sector is undergoing a severe bifurcation. It's essentially splitting into two distinct economies operating under the same umbrella.
Okay, break that down for me.
Well, on one side of the split, you have traditional, high-volume, lower-complexity manufacturing. This might involve producing standard consumer goods, basic materials, or commodities, where the primary competitive advantage historically was just low labor costs.
And because Australia is a high-wage economy, that specific subsector struggles to compete with overseas markets where, frankly, overheads are a fraction of the cost.
Precisely. I mean, that is the crux of the issue for that side of the industry. They face relentless margin pressure, fierce international competition, and they are the ones primarily responsible for the aggregate job losses.
Yeah, they're just getting squeezed out.
Right. They're shedding headcount because the traditional model is becoming financially untenable. But then you look at the other side of the bifurcation.
The new world.
Yeah, the high-value, highly complex, advanced manufacturing space. We are talking about defense-related production, clean energy infrastructure, advanced medical devices, sophisticated battery technologies, aerospace components.
Ah, right. This is where all the noise is coming from regarding government investment, isn't it? We hear constant discussion about the Future Made in Australia initiative and the National Reconstruction Fund.
Spot on.
So this high-value side is where the capital's flowing.
It is where the capital is absolutely flooding in, and it is entirely driven by a concept that has dominated industrial policy since the supply chain shocks of the early 2020s.
Sovereign capability.
Exactly, sovereign capability.
We should define the mechanics of sovereign capability because, you know, it is more than just a political talking point. It represents a fundamental rewiring of how risk is calculated in a boardroom.
It changes everything.
It does. Because for the last 30 years, the driving mechanism of global supply chains was cost efficiency. A company would identify the cheapest possible location on Earth to manufacture a component and build this incredibly fragile, just-in-time logistics network to deliver it.
And the geopolitical shifts and pandemic-era border closures completely exposed the fatal flaw in that model.
Right, they shattered it.
Yeah, because a cheap supply chain is a massive liability. If a single geopolitical event or a logistics bottleneck can completely sever your access to critical goods,
Which we saw
you
happen.
saw it repeatedly. So boardrooms and governments recognize that relying entirely on offshore production for essential items like pharmaceutical precursors, military components, or the transformers needed for the energy grid is a profound national security vulnerability.
It's not just business anymore.
No, it's survival. So sovereign capability is the mandate to build and maintain the physical infrastructure and the human talent required to produce those critical assets domestically.
Which fundamentally changes the economic equation.
How so?
Well, if a domestic battery plant is considered essential for national security, it doesn't necessarily have to beat the lowest global price point to survive, does it?
Yeah.
It has to offer security of supply.
Right.
And that mandate shields these high-value subsectors. It attracts massive government and private capital, and it allows them to generate those massive profit margins we were talking about earlier.
It does, but it also creates the central friction of our paradox.
The talent issue.
Yes,
Yeah.
because the skills required to operate a legacy textile facility are not readily transferable to a highly automated clean room manufacturing medical implants.
Right.
So the sector is shedding workers in the traditional spaces, but the booming advanced spaces cannot easily absorb those specific workers because the technical demands are entirely different.
This brings us right to the actual talent shortage. If the sector lost 8,700 jobs, a casual observer might just assume, well, the labor market is fairly loose right now.
You'd think so.
But the Australian Bureau of Statistics reported 18,600 manufacturing job vacancies in February 2026, which is a 3.6% year-on-year increase.
Which is staggering when you're also losing jobs.
Exactly. Furthermore, the Australian Industry Group released data showing 71% of industry leaders expect their workforce shortages to persist indefinitely.
Wow.
Yeah. This is not a cyclical dip where demand has temporarily spiked. This is a structural failure in the labor supply.
What's fascinating here is that it's a structural failure driven by what McKinsey refers to as the capability
The
mix.
capability mix.
Yeah. The constraint limiting growth in these high-value facilities is not a lack of headcount in a general sense. It is the absence of a highly specific blend of skills.
Right.
When a manufacturer installs a $30 million automated assembly line, replete with smart sensors and robotics, they don't merely eliminate manual roles. They radically alter the nature of the work for the humans who actually remain on the floor.
Let's unpack that capability mix on the shop floor then, because the assumption is often that factories just need, tech geeks in hard hats to run the robots.
Right, that's the stereotype.
Yeah, but a traditional computer scientist isn't necessarily going to understand the physical tolerances of an industrial metal press. So what does this hybrid capability actually look like in practice for a frontline worker?
Well, consider the role of a maintenance fitter. 10 years ago, a fitter's primary objective was to repair a machine after it had broken down.
Right, wait for it to break, then fix it.
Exactly. It was reactive mechanical work. But today, that role has evolved into a reliability engineer. They are not waiting for a breakdown. They are monitoring a continuous feed of digital data.
Oh, well,
They're looking at vibration analysis and thermal imaging data sent from sensors embedded deep inside the machinery. Their job is to interpret that data, predict that a specific bearing will fail in exactly 3 weeks, and schedule a targeted intervention that prevents any unplanned downtime.
Because in a highly automated facility, downtime is the ultimate enemy.
It's financially ruinous.
Right. If one robotic arm halts, the entire multi-million dollar production cell stops dead. The financial penalty of a breakdown is vastly higher than it was on a traditional assembly line.
The cost of downtime is absolutely astronomical now, and this need for hybrid skills extends way beyond just maintenance. Take quality control.
Yeah.
Modern facilities are desperate for quality leads who are experts in methodologies like Lean and Six Sigma.
Now, we hear Lean and Six Sigma frequently in standard corporate settings, but how do they function mechanistically in a digitized manufacturing environment? I mean, it isn't just about keeping the warehouse tidy, surely.
Far from it. Six Sigma, at its core, is a statistical methodology designed to ruthlessly eliminate variance in a process.
Right.
In a traditional setting, a quality inspector might physically measure one out of every 100 widgets produced.
Spot checking.
Yeah, spot checking. But in an Industry 4.0 facility, sensors measure every single widget in real time. If there is a slight variance in the raw material entering the automated system, the robots don't know any better. They'll continue to process it, potentially manufacturing defects at terrifying speeds.
Because automating a flawed process merely scales the flaw.
Precisely the issue. Therefore, the Six Sigma expert must analyze massive data sets to identify microscopic variances in the inputs or the machine calibration and adjust the digital parameters before the physical defect even occurs.
Wow.
They are quality controlling the data environment just as much as the physical product.
That is a massive shift in responsibility. Mm. And I want to look at the corporate functions too, because the Byron Thomas briefing heavily emphasizes a shortage of talent in HR and finance within the manufacturing sector.
Yeah, which surprises a lot of people.
It does, because people think, well, an accountant is an accountant, surely. Why is a manufacturing CFO suddenly such a difficult role to fill?
Because the role of a manufacturing CFO has transformed into one of the most complex financial positions in the modern economy.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. They are no longer simply managing payroll, tracking standard inventory, and preparing annual tax filings. They are tasked with modeling the financial viability of multi-year capital projects involving technologies that are evolving faster than their depreciation schedules.
Give me a scenario. What is a CFO actually dealing with on, say, a Tuesday afternoon?
Right. Imagine a CFO evaluating a proposal to transition from a traditional gas-powered furnace to an electrified, highly automated system. They're doing this to meet new environmental regulations and secure a sovereign capability government grant. They have to model the capital expenditure of the equipment against highly volatile projected energy prices over the next decade.
Which is incredibly unpredictable right now.
Extremely. Plus, they have to factor in the specific compliance metrics tied to the government funding. They have to model the cost of retraining the entire floor staff to operate the new system.
Right.
And they're doing all of this while simultaneously managing the intense working capital pressures of a global supply chain that is constantly disrupted by geopolitical events.
It requires a financial leader who deeply understands industrial engineering, energy markets, government policy, and digital transformation.
Exactly. It requires a strategist, not just a bookkeeper.
And the same complexity applies to human resources, doesn't it?
Yeah.
An HR business partner transitioning from a standard corporate office to a manufacturing environment faces an incredibly steep learning curve.
It's a completely different world.
It is. They have to navigate complex industrial relations frameworks, union negotiations, rigorous safety and compliance mandates, and the intricate logistics of a 247 multi-shift workforce. You simply cannot manage a factory floor with generic corporate wellness initiatives.
You really can't. And this brings us to the technological elephant in the room, really.
AI.
Yeah. We are discussing the need for workers who can manage data, interpret sensors, and model complex scenarios. The immediate assumption everyone makes is that artificial intelligence is stepping in to bridge this gap.
Right. AI is always positioned as the universal solvent for productivity issues. But the data tells a remarkably different story about its actual deployment on the ground.
It really does.
We looked at PwC's 2025 Global Workforce Hopes and Fears Survey, which surveyed Australian workers. And while the general sentiment towards AI is relatively optimistic, the practical application is severely lacking.
The numbers are quite low.
Extremely low.
Yeah.
Only 10% of Australian workers report using generative AI on a daily basis. That is already lagging behind the global average of 14%.
But the most revealing aspect of that PwC data is the distribution of that 10%.
Right. Where is it actually happening?
Well, the daily usage of AI is heavily concentrated in knowledge work and administrative roles. It is the marketing team drafting copy or the finance team writing macros in Excel.
The office staff.
Yeah. The actual production workers, the people physically responsible for the output of the sector, are largely bypassing these tools entirely.
This creates what PwC terms an adoption gap. You have the C-suite investing heavily in enterprise AI licenses, assuming it will just organically cascade down and magically improve productivity on the shop floor.
Which is a fundamental misunderstanding of the technology.
It is.
Yeah.
Because you cannot simply issue an iPad with an AI application to a welder and expect an immediate transformation in output.
Exactly. Technology deployment without capability building is just wasted capital. The frontline workers lack the highly tailored practical tools that integrate seamlessly with their physical tasks. But more importantly, they lack the supervisors who possess the time, the digital literacy, and the change management skills to actually coach them through the adoption process.
And this friction in adopting AI points directly to the broader framework of Industry 4.0.
Yes, it's all connected.
KPMG provided a fantastic roadmap for this in their recent reports, positioning Industry 4.0 not just as an operational upgrade, but as the mandatory pathway to achieving the sovereign capability we discussed earlier.
It's the only way forward.
If an Australian manufacturer wants to compete globally while paying high domestic wages, they absolutely must leverage robotics, sensors, additive manufacturing like industrial 3D printing, and interconnectivity to drastically increase their output per worker.
And KPMG breaks this transition down into three necessary phases.
Let's hear them.
Phase one is enabling people and foundations. Now, this is the unglamorous work of cleaning up legacy data architectures and training staff on basic digital hygiene.
The boring but essential stuff.
Exactly, because you cannot deploy an advanced predictive AI if the machine data it relies upon is corrupt or trapped in a silo.
Makes sense.
Then phase two is embedding AI into workflows. This ensures the technology operates seamlessly within the daily routine rather than just acting as some isolated experiment in the corner of the factory.
Right.
And finally, phase three is evolving models across ecosystems where your internal systems communicate autonomously with your suppliers and your logistics providers.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting. It is within this Industry 4.0 framework that I found one of the most compelling insights in the source material.
Oh, from the KPMG Tech Report.
Yes. In KPMG's 2026 Global Tech Report, they survey industrial technology leaders, and a significant majority anticipate that managing AI agents will become a critical workplace skill within the next 5 years.
That is a huge distinction to make.
It is, and we need to distinguish between using an AI tool and managing an AI agent, because the implications for the workforce are massive.
They are completely different paradigms. A tool is passive, right? A spreadsheet or a basic algorithm requires a human to input data, direct the function, and interpret the output.
It waits for instructions.
Exactly. But an AI agent is autonomous. It is a software entity that is given a broad parameter, for instance, optimize the energy consumption of the cooling system without letting the core temperature exceed standard limits.
Okay.
And then it continuously monitors data, makes decisions, and executes adjustments without any human intervention.
So think about this. If you are a plant supervisor managing a shift, your team no longer consists solely of human operators. Your team actually includes autonomous software agents executing critical functions.
Which is mind-bending for a lot of legacy managers.
Absolutely. How does a supervisor actually manage that dynamic? Do they conduct a performance review on an algorithm?
Well, the core competency of a frontline leader undergoes a radical shift here. Technical expertise in the machinery remains important, sure, but it is no longer sufficient. The primary skill becomes the orchestration of a hybrid workforce. It is fundamentally a challenge of change leadership.
Break down that change leadership for me. What does that supervisor actually have to do on a daily basis?
They have to manage the human psychological response to the technology.
Ah, the fear and the skepticism.
Exactly. They must coach an experienced, perhaps highly skeptical human technician to actually trust the predictive maintenance alert generated by the AI agent, even if the machine sounds perfectly fine to the human ear.
Which goes against decades of their instinct.
It does. And simultaneously, the supervisor must possess enough digital literacy to understand the parameters of the AI agent themselves. They need to identify when the agent is hallucinating or operating on flawed data and know how to intervene safely.
That requires an exceptional level of emotional intelligence combined with a deep understanding of systems architecture.
It's a very rare breed.
It is an incredibly rare combination of skills, which completely explains why the middle management layer is under such acute pressure right now. The people who can navigate both the human anxieties and the algorithmic parameters are the linchpins of the entire transition.
And because that talent is so scarce, manufacturers are increasingly turning to external expertise. When internal capability falls short of strategic ambition, the sector inevitably looks to the consulting industry.
Right, and the hiring patterns of the big four consulting firms, specifically Deloitte and EY, serve as a remarkably accurate diagnostic tool for the manufacturing industry's pain points.
They're a great barometer.
They really are. A major manufacturer does not engage a premium consulting firm unless they are facing a problem that is complex, high stakes, and completely unsolvable internally.
So by analyzing the specific roles Deloitte and EY are actively recruiting for, we can reverse engineer the exact anxieties keeping manufacturing CEOs awake at night.
Let's do it. What are they hiring for?
Well, the Byron Thomas research details that Deloitte's industrial transformation teams are aggressively hiring professionals with deep backgrounds in defense programs, energy transition strategies, capital asset management, and supply chain resilience.
Meanwhile, EY is actively hunting for supply chain and operations consultants who specialize in manufacturing excellence, lean implementations, and the design of digital supply chains.
Very specific niches.
Extremely. And what strikes me is the stark contrast between these current mandates and the consulting trends of, say, a decade ago.
Oh, it's night and day.
10 years ago, a manufacturer brought in a consultant to execute cost-out strategies, didn't they? To identify redundancies, streamline operations, and prepare for offshoring.
Yeah, cost reduction is no longer the primary directive. The mandates have shifted entirely toward complex program delivery.
Give me an example of that.
So a manufacturer might have successfully secured a government grant and board approval for a $50 million facility upgrade to build advanced components. The capital is there. The technology exists.
Okay, so what's the problem?
The bottleneck is execution. How do you implement a digital transformation across a legacy facility without halting current production? How do you re-architect a global supply chain to withstand the next geopolitical shock?
To solve those problems, both the consulting firms and the manufacturers themselves are desperately searching for a specific profile, the cross-functional leader.
Yes.
Historically, manufacturing has been a heavily siloed environment. Operations managed the shop floor and physical output. The IT department managed the servers and the software. Finance handled the capital allocation and margin analysis.
And they never spoke to each other.
Right. They operated in parallel, often speaking entirely different professional languages.
But in an Industry 4.0 environment, those silos are fatal. If a physical production line is entirely governed by a continuous data stream, operations and IT cannot exist as separate entities. They are intrinsically linked.
They have to be.
Furthermore, if that automated line represents a massive capital investment with highly sensitive depreciation and energy costs, operations and finance must be deeply integrated as well.
So we need leaders who can translate across those domains. You need an operations director who can interrogate a data architecture diagram. You need a supply chain manager who understands the nuanced commercial pressures of working capital.
Exactly.
You need a technologist who comprehends the physical constraints and safety protocols of heavy machinery.
And this demand for cross-functional capability aligns perfectly with the strategic direction outlined in the CSIRO Advanced Manufacturing Roadmap.
Oh, that's a brilliant document.
It is. The roadmap argues that the fundamental source of economic value within manufacturing has shifted completely. In the 20th century, the value was captured in the assembly phase, right? The efficient mass production of physical goods.
But assembly is increasingly becoming the most commoditized and easily automated part of the entire process. If a robotic arm can assemble the product faster and with less variance than a human, the margin on the assembly itself naturally shrinks.
Exactly. The CSIRO roadmap demonstrates that the high margin value has migrated to the edges of the manufacturing process.
The edge?
Yeah. It sits at the very beginning in advanced research and development, materials science, bespoke engineering, and complex customization. And it also sits at the very end in after-sales services, ongoing sensor monitoring, and predictive maintenance contracts.
Right, the product as a service model.
Precisely.
If an Australian company manufactures a highly specialized pump for the mining sector, the initial sale of the physical pump is only a fraction of the total revenue.
A very small fraction.
The real value is the 10-year service contract, where the manufacturer monitors the digital twin of the pump, analyzes the sensor data, and provides preventative maintenance to guarantee zero downtime for the mining operator.
And to execute that model, a manufacturer must transform into a hybrid technology and services company. They require R&D scientists, software developers to build the digital twins, data analysts to monitor the inputs, and commercial teams capable of structuring these incredibly complex service agreements.
This brings us to a massive practical hurdle.
The recruitment aspect.
Yes. A manufacturing firm reads the CSIRO roadmap, understands they need data scientists, cross-functional finance leaders, and digital supply chain experts. But they are competing for that exact same talent pool against tech companies, massive financial institutions, and the mining sector.
Which is a tough sell.
Why would a highly sought-after data analyst choose to work for a manufacturing plant over a bank?
That is the central challenge for the employer value proposition over the next decade. If we look at the projections from Jobs and Skills Australia, they forecast a significant long-term expansion for the sector.
Okay, what are the numbers?
They estimate employment will grow from roughly 881,000 in May 2023 to 1,025,000 by May 2033. Crossing that 1 million job threshold requires attracting a massive influx of net new talent.
But the sector is fighting a severe perception problem. It is battling the outdated stereotype of the dark, dusty, declining industry, while simultaneously competing against the modern realities of post-pandemic work preferences.
The shift toward remote and hybrid work has fundamentally disadvantaged sectors reliant on physical presence. I mean, a commercial bank can offer a data scientist the ability to work from home 3 days a week and set their own hours. A manufacturing facility cannot run an automated clean room remotely. Shift work, strict safety protocols, and physical attendance are largely non-negotiable.
So if an employer is asking a candidate to sacrifice the flexibility of remote work, they have to offer compelling alternatives. Candidates want robust, structured training. They demand an impeccable safety culture. They want whatever shift flexibility can practically be managed.
And something else, too.
What's that?
Perhaps most significantly, according to the research, they are searching for a tangible sense of purpose.
Ah, right. Purpose.
An emphasis on purpose is particularly pronounced among Gen Z candidates entering the workforce. McKinsey's operations research dispels the myth that younger generations are inherently opposed to manufacturing.
They aren't.
Not at all. They are fairly receptive to the sector, provided the narrative is articulated correctly.
Right. If a hiring manager simply pitches the job as operating a machine to hit a daily quota, the candidate will look elsewhere immediately.
Of course.
But if the employer can connect the daily tasks to a broader mission, such as we are manufacturing the critical battery components necessary to decarbonize the energy grid, or we are securing the local supply chain for essential medical devices, that framing resonates deeply. It connects the immediate role to a global imperative.
Articulating purpose is essential, but it must be paired with clear, visible pathways for progression. A candidate needs to see the modern tools they will be operating and understand the trajectory of their career over the next 5 years.
Makes sense.
However, while establishing purpose and pathways is vital for long-term attraction, the immediate reality on the ground is far more desperate.
I want to highlight a statistic from the UKG 2025 ANZ research that illustrates the sheer scale of the desperation right now. We know that 79% of manufacturers are struggling to source skilled tradespeople.
We covered that, yeah.
But the UKG data revealed that over 60% of surveyed manufacturers admitted they had hired people into essential roles over the past year who possessed absolutely no prior experience in the manufacturing industry.
Over 6 in 10 essential hires have never worked in a factory environment before.
That's crazy.
It is a staggering reflection of the exhausted talent pool.
I have to challenge the logic of this approach, though. We have spent the last 45 minutes establishing that modern manufacturing involves complex data systems, multi-million-dollar robotics, high-stakes, sovereign capability mandates, and strict safety regulations.
Right.
How can an industry with this level of operational risk justify filling the majority of its essential vacancies with people who have zero industry context? Is that not a recipe for catastrophic failure?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is not a preference. It is an absolute necessity.
What do you mean?
The traditional talent pool candidates with a decade of specific manufacturing experience has been fully absorbed. They are all employed. If an operations manager insists on waiting for a perfect resume, the automated line will sit idle, the supply contracts will be breached, and the facility will fail.
So they have no choice.
Widen the funnel or halt production. Those are the only two options available.
Okay. But if an employer is forced to hire a former retail supervisor or a hospitality manager to run a production shift, how do they actually make that transition successful?
They have to completely recalibrate their assessment criteria. You stop screening for past technical experience and begin screening for innate aptitude and adjacent skills.
Give me an example of an adjacent skill.
Consider a candidate who has managed a large hospitality venue. They possess demonstrable experience in managing diverse teams across rotating, unsociable shifts.
Okay, that translates well.
They are accustomed to enforcing strict health and safety protocols under pressure. They understand rapid problem solving when a process breaks down.
Right. Those are adjacent core competencies. The specific technical knowledge of how to calibrate the industrial sensor can be taught through structured training.
Exactly.
But the resilience, the shift management capability, and the safety mindset are much harder to instill from scratch.
Exactly. This dynamic fundamentally shifts the responsibility of the employer. They can no longer operate merely as consumers of talent. They must become active creators of talent.
I like that phrase, creators of talent.
It's true. The willingness to hire for adjacency must be supported by an intense commitment to onboarding, continuous mentorship, and the deployment of micro-credentials.
Which provides the perfect transition into the actionable strategies. We understand the macroeconomic data, the technical evolution on the shop floor, and the severe constraints of the talent pool.
A whole picture.
So what does this all mean? If you're a CEO, a CFO, or an HR director listening to this, you need a pragmatic response. Based on the Byron Thomas recruitment briefing, we can distill the necessary strategic shift into five core pillars of action.
Let's run through them.
Let's examine pillar number one, treating the workforce as capital allocation.
This first pillar requires a fundamental shift in corporate accounting philosophy, directly targeting the CFO.
Okay.
Historically, capital expenditure CapEx has been reserved for physical assets. You buy a robotic arm, it goes on the balance sheet, and it depreciates over time. Training and hiring, conversely, are treated as operating expenses, OPEX. They sit within the annual HR budget.
And the problem with OPEX is that it is highly vulnerable, isn't it? If the company faces margin pressure, the training budget is often the first line item to be slashed.
Every time.
So a company might successfully install a $10 million automated system, but abruptly cancel the training program for the operators.
Which renders the asset entirely useless. KPMG and McKinsey argue that this siloed accounting model is broken. Financial leaders must model the business case for new technology and the capability required to operate it as a single, unified investment story.
They have to be tied together.
Yes. When the CFO approves the capital for the machinery, they must simultaneously ring-fence the capital required to hire, onboard, and continuously upskill the workforce attached to that machinery. Training is no longer an administrative overhead. It is direct operational value creation.
Pillar number two leans heavily on our previous point. Hire for adjacent skills, then train aggressively.
Right, the hospitality manager example.
Exactly. The Byron Thomas briefing warns that the opportunity cost of an unfilled vacancy in an Industry 4.0 environment is simply too high. You cannot afford to wait.
It connects directly to the mandate from the Manufacturing Industry Skills Alliance as well.
What was their take?
The sector requires a responsive, modular skills system. Employers must build robust internal training architectures, utilizing micro-credentials and targeted upskilling, so they have the confidence to hire a candidate with 60% of the required skills and actively build the remaining 40% in-house.
That makes perfect sense. Now, pillar number three focuses on the attraction strategy. Segment the employer value proposition. Or EVP. We discussed the desire for flexibility, but applying a generic corporate definition of flexibility across an entire manufacturing business is destined to fail.
Oh, a singular homogenous culture statement is totally ineffective here.
Why is that?
Well, the flexibility desired by a financial controller in the corporate office, perhaps a hybrid model of 3 days in the office and two at home, is physically impossible for a reliability engineer monitoring a continuous production line.
Right. For the engineer, flexibility might mean a highly predictable roster, the ability to easily swap shifts to manage family commitments, or guaranteed access to specific upskilling programs.
Spot on.
The HR function must segment the messaging. The job advertisement for the shop floor must clearly articulate the specific, practical benefits relevant to that physical environment, rather than relying on vague corporate platitudes.
Right. And pillar number four is about visibility. Upgrade workforce data. This directly addresses the AI adoption gap highlighted by PwC.
How does data fix that?
A manufacturer cannot effectively train their workforce for the future if they possess zero empirical data on the skills their employees currently hold today.
It is remarkable how many organizations have real-time dashboards tracking the granular performance of their machines. Yet they rely on outdated spreadsheets or anecdotal assumptions regarding the capability of their staff.
It happens all the time. Implementing comprehensive, transparent skills inventories is essential. Management must uncover the hidden capabilities within their ranks.
Because they might already have the talent they need.
Exactly. An assembly worker might possess informal coding skills. A maintenance fitter might have an unrecognized aptitude for data analysis. Understanding the baseline capability allows the organization to make informed strategic decisions about when to hire externally and when to invest in targeted internal development.
Finally, pillar number five, targeted executive search. This applies specifically to the critical transformational roles we have discussed, the plant managers, the cross-functional CFOs, the shift-savvy HR directors.
Relying on generic recruitment methodologies for these pivotal positions is highly risky.
Really?
Absolutely. Posting an advertisement on a broad job board is very unlikely to attract a financial leader capable of navigating a complex industry 4.0 transition and managing sovereign capability grants.
The Byron Thomas briefing strongly advocates for engaging boutique search partners who maintain deep, pre-existing networks, specifically within the advanced manufacturing ecosystem.
It saves so much time.
And time is everything. These partners can assess cultural alignment and technical capability far more rapidly and accurately than a standard internal process. Speed is the critical factor here.
It is.
If a company identifies a candidate who possesses both the technical acumen and the change leadership skills required, a slow, bureaucratic interview process will result in losing that candidate to a competitor who can move decisively.
In a structurally constrained talent market, the speed and clarity of your recruitment process are significant competitive advantages.
We have covered an immense landscape today, mapping the transition of an entire sector. Let's distill this down to the immediate actionable takeaways based on your role in the industry.
Good idea.
If you are a CEO or a board member listening to this, the primary directive is this. A sophisticated technological strategy is entirely theoretical without a corresponding capability plan. You cannot purchase your way out of a productivity deficit with machinery alone. The human element must be integrated into every capital decision.
What about operations?
If you lead operations, shift your focus from headcount to the capability mix. The critical bottleneck is likely not a general lack of personnel, but the absence of the specific cross-functional skills required to bridge your legacy processes with your new digital systems.
And HR.
For HR leaders, speed, segmented clarity, and the construction of highly visible internal development pathways are your strongest tools. Widen the applicant funnel by targeting adjacent competencies and support those hires with rigorous onboarding. For CFOs, the traditional divide between OPEX and CAPEX must be completely reevaluated. The budgets for technological acquisition and workforce capability must be modeled interdependently.
And finally, the candidates.
Right. If you are a candidate navigating this landscape, recognize that your value is shifting. Your ability to communicate across disciplines, your baseline digital literacy, and your capacity to adapt to new systems are your true trade skills now.
Those are the practical imperatives, but I would like to conclude with a broader reflection on the trajectory of the industry as a whole.
Please do.
We noted the UKG data indicating that over 60% of essential new hires lack prior manufacturing experience. We also highlighted KPMG's projection that managing autonomous AI agents will soon be a critical core competency.
It paints a picture of an industry undergoing a complete metamorphosis.
It really does, and this raises an important question for the next decade. If the traditional reservoir of industry experience is depleted, and the future of shop floor leadership revolves around orchestrating algorithms and managing complex human-machine interactions, is the future of manufacturing fundamentally decoupled from its industrial past?
Wow.
Consider the possibility that the most effective transformative plant manager of 2035, the leader who drives unprecedented innovation and efficiency, might be an individual who, today, has never once stepped inside a traditional factory.
I think that is an incredibly powerful idea to end on. The notion that the industry's greatest future assets are currently outsiders completely reframes how we should be thinking about talent. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the realities of the modern manufacturing sector. We hope you walk away with a clearer understanding of the forces shaping the future of work and the strategies required to navigate them. We will see you next time.